Welcome to another episode of Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden, the podcast about books and ideas. I'm Tim Trash.
I am Joaquin Lobo.
And we'll be your hosts for the next hour. Joaquin, for the 43rd time. How are you?
43rd time. That's a lot of times. When are we going to stop? We said we're going to do 10. 43? Yeah. Come on. That's too many. I'm sick of listening to myself. I love listening to you, but I'm sick of listening to myself.
Now we have to go at least until 250, I think.
250.
Yeah.
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you, Tim Trash. Life is good. I feel like nothing changes. COVID is back. Trump is back. We still have a war in Ukraine. It's like the same as they won. It's crazy.
It is. It is. But he's also been indicted now 3 times. Trump has been. So like my very sincere hope is that they're just going to bury him under charges until something sticks and he has to go to jail. So,
well, this is the good one in theory. You know, you could argue that Jack Smith put together the perfect case against Donald Trump. But the big question, and I had this conversation yesterday with some friends in San Francisco, I was saying he's going to jail. You know, if you follow the logic of the law enforcement in America and justice and all of that, you could argue that he needs to go to jail, but he's not going to go to jail.
It makes sense
that he goes to jail, but he's not going to go to jail. Just this morning, I think I was listening to former general attorney. What's his name? This guy.
Bill Barr?
Yeah, Bill Barr was saying, that would be unthinkable in America. It would set a terrible example, like an American president going to jail. It's like, why? What's so special about a fucking American president? If you can send presidents to jail in other countries, why not this crook?
Yeah, yeah. But I think he's singing a different tune now. I mean, Bill Barr, I mean, of all people, has experienced a weird turnaround, like from total Trump loyalist to pretty outspoken
critic.
Because
he's selling books now. He wants to sell books. Wouldn't you do the same? I'd do anything to sell more books. I talk shit about you. If I had to sell books, I talk shit about my friend Stephen King. That guy is a horrible guy. You know, we recorded all these episodes for a podcast. Don't ever read his books.
Selling books, which brings me, we have two guests. It's only the second episode that we have with two guests, and they're very good friends of mine. So I'm super, super happy to introduce Dominic Stansberry and Gillian Connolly. Gillian just put out her 9th collection of poetry, Notes from the Passenger. It was published by Nightboat Books this year. And she has received the Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America, and her translations of 3 books by Henri Michaux, 1,000 Times Broken, was published by City Lights. Gillian has won pretty much every award I know, and she has taught as a visiting poet at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, the University of Denver, Vermont College, Tulane University, and until just this spring, she was the professor of English and poet in residence at Sonoma State University, where we taught together. And she also edited there the literary magazine Vault, among a lot of other things. Dominic Stansberry is the Edgar Award-winning author of 10 novels and a collection of stories. And for his most recent novel, The White Devil, he received the Hammett Prize for Literary Excellence in Crime Fiction. His earlier work includes the North Beach Mystery Series, which received wide praise for its portrayal of the ethnic and political subcultures of San Francisco. And his books have been translated into numerous languages. There are Japanese editions, Italian, French, Spanish, and Polish, among others. So two highly, highly, highly accomplished writers. Welcome, Dominic and Gillian.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
We're also married, by the way.
Yeah.
You guys know that, but Mama.
You make us sound so good.
Yeah, because that's because you are great.
Okay.
Well, I'll go with that.
We forget. We're just drinking coffee.
Yeah. Trying to get through the day. I try to ignore the news as much as possible because there does a certain sameness to them, you know, but somehow I end up being on the computer at the times or getting news at the times I would at least want to get it. Like I happen to have been on doing something, I think looking myself up on the computer or something for a bio when this 9/11 crash happened and they went into the giant building. So I try to ignore it, but it somehow gets in anyway.
Yeah, that's my dream. I want to retire and ignore the news for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I try to do it. I really try because it's hard to get any thought, anything done constructive.
Yeah,
exactly. Or to keep the anxiety out of your head because they're constantly spinning some new horror.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, I think it's taking years off my life. I'm going to die younger because of Donald Trump.
Right. He sucks all the air out of the whole universe.
I didn't know, Dominic, that you and Tim Trash was reading your bios. I was like, oh, these people know North Beach and, you know, so well, and probably hung out with Lawrence Ferlinghetti and had martinis at Tosca or has cappuccinos at Tosca. We should talk about North Beach. I'm sure we have friends in common in that area.
We may. Who do you know?
Unless they're all dead with concrete shoes.
Well, that's also part of the problem. Lawrence is gone. Who do you know down there, Joaquin?
Well, you know Mark Alvarez, the cop?
No. Might go through a lot. Anybody a cop.
We don't know policemen.
I should know Mark Alvarez. I've met Lawrence in passing a couple different times, and he sort of knew who I was. And I know some of the shop restaurant people. And so I kept a low profile when I was in North Beach because I didn't really want to be. I spent a lot of time down there, but I just would watch, and I'd hang around, but I didn't really want to be known.
Well, that's smart. I spent too much time at Tosca and Trieste and hanging out at the bars at Specs at this.
Yeah. I know those places. Did you know
who was the woman who used to own Tosca?
Yeah, do you remember
Jeanette?
Yeah, Jeanette. I knew Jeanette. Yeah, I didn't know Jeanette well, but I knew Jeanette, and that was an example of maybe not wanting to be known because she read some of the books, and then she had objections to this or that. And but she was nice enough, you know. I mean, she was cool enough about it. But they put not totally without my knowledge, they took a book that wasn't even set in North Beach. They took it and put a book that was set in L.A. They took to the inside of some Getty stock photo. They used it on St. Martin's used it on the cover of Manifesto for the Dead. I think that was the name of that book. And she was upset about it because it was a picture of the inside of her restaurant. But I think it was back from the 20s or something. It was probably public.
Oh, really?
So she called me up. About it. So why did you put that quota on the cover of my book? And well, how did you do that? And then you owe me, and she won some money or something, but she wasn't serious about it. She had just been, you know, how Jeanette was.
There was also a typo in the book where it was called Tosca's instead of Tosca.
Oh yeah.
And she got really pissed off about it.
I think that was just my ignorance. I don't think it was even a typo. I think I just did it wrong. But so you get a lot of things like that if when you write a series set in a place. It's not Grant Avenue, it's Grant Street. You know, there's not this on that corner. Of course, I know that I'm going to get mixed up about some stuff, but I know certain stuff. I mean, I changed the geography a little bit, you know, for the sake of, you know, the fiction.
No, I'm lucky. She was always very nice to me and she was very kind every time. I used to be a regular at Tosca until the very last day. The day it closed, I was invited to the last party.
We were probably in there at the same time sometimes then.
Yeah.
And I never go back. I've never been back. I feel
we went back once.
Oh, I was.
It like the floor is the same, and the remember the red couches.
Yeah,
those are all still there. You recognize it, but it's I think they put in like, you know, fancy light fixtures. It's way too clean, and it's much more expensive. But what I remember was seeing in the old days, you could see Coppola there, yeah. You know, yeah. And there was a back room where, you know, you're basically.
I know that room very well. I used to play pool in the back room. And you could smoke.
You were a non-person there.
That was the only place in San Francisco where you could smoke. Because
yeah, right. I smoked out back there too in that room.
Yeah.
And one time we saw Nicolas Cage.
Oh.
Yeah. He was so happy to be recognized. It was really funny.
That's a good story. Yeah, yeah, the one that I like, my favorite anecdote is Hunter S. Thompson getting drunk, and he was like jumping up and down on a table. He fell, broke one of his ankles, and they came for him. The ambulance says, "Leave me alone, let me go. I'm a doctor."
Well, that character is kind of gone from there. But we did have a good time sitting in there. You know, it's an overpriced restaurant, like everything is overpriced.
Yeah.
But it still has the bar. It still has some of the old ambiance. I hated it right after they did it. I was totally offended by the change when it first happened, right? Yeah. But going in there, like however many years it's been now, it was actually okay. You know, we sat there and had a good time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and had some drinks and paid $2.20 for it. They have food there now.
It was expensive. Yeah.
But it wasn't any more expensive than every other place being overpriced and expensive. Yeah.
It's right across from City Lights. So
and we went to Specs, really, you know, Specs afterwards.
Yeah.
Convenient. And it wasn't, you know, enough time had passed where it felt okay to go in there. But Specs is still Specs.
I just feel that way about San Francisco these days. Like the end of Tosca to me, in a way, was the end of San Francisco. It kind of looks the same, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
I always wanted to totally change subject. I always wanted to ask you one thing. You're maybe the only couple I know who both ride and don't hate each other. So I always wondered how, like, you're so easy and good together, and you seem to have so much fun. And I always wondered, is it because you both write, but you're writing in very different genres? Or is it because you never talk about it? Or is it because you talk about it, but you're not in the same genre? Like, how have you worked that out not to be competitive? I know one friend of mine, he and his wife both wrote, but they wouldn't read each other's work just to keep that out of the relationship. And it always struck me as kind of weird because it's such a big part of your life. But they were like sort of, they totally cut that off. Like, they didn't even know what they were working on, or only maybe after publication they could read it. And so I was wondering how you guys made that work with, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go first, John?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I remember when, I think Dominic and I have been together about 40 years. But I remember that we met when we were in graduate school in Amherst, Massachusetts, and Dominic is a novelist, and he had really good habits as a writer, you know, of writing for a long every day, mm-hmm. and for, you know, a couple of hours a day, and he was just real rigid about it, and I was much more loosey goosey about the whole thing and wrote so I really liked hooking up with Dominic. In the old use of the word, of the phrase, because I developed better writing habits because of it. But to answer your larger question, I think it probably does help a lot that we're such different writers, you know, because the poetry world is so different than a novelist world, and but we do read each other's work and we do talk about each other's work.
Mm-hmm.
And we're friends.
I'm a little more less likely to show Gillian work in progress. It has to be to a certain place. And I, but Gillian's, before I let somebody look at it, just she'll know what I'm working on because I talk about it. But I'm a little more reluctant to let her look, anybody look at stuff, because it's still kind of a mess, you know, and I don't want any feedback until it's to a certain spot, you know, until mm-hmm. I can use it. Gillian's working all the time, and I find her stuff just lying around, and I've always liked her poetry. And so it does help that we're in such different genres, because she's sort of a, you know, for lack of a better word, postmodernist type of poet, you know, and I'm a crime writer. So they're very different worlds in some ways. And I don't even mingle too much in the larger world, whereas Gillian is kind of more known and as an editor and that kind of thing. So, and writing a novel is kind of a long, lonely, horrible business. So it's nice to have somebody around and see, run across their stuff and look at it and see work that gets, that has that energy and vitality in it. But, you know, we are competitive to some degree. I mean, because that's just life. People are competitive. You know, that's just the way, I think that's the way humans are. I mean, I wish that we weren't competitive. But, you know, careers take different cycles. And there's times when you know, much as I hate to, like, you know, say that career, that kind of stuff feels like important, but it is, you know. And there's sometimes when you're getting like maybe more attention, or the other person's getting more attention, and it teaches you not to take that stuff like too seriously. Maybe, I mean, you do take it seriously, but I do take it seriously, but try not to. And also, you know, a writer's career, as you both know, is a, both Tim and Joaquin know well, is that it's a long thing. And and if you're always worrying about what's going on outside of you, in terms of like what kind of attention or this going on with the work or what may or may not be being said about it, then you're not going to hang with it for too long, I don't think. Or it can get, I see so many people that get kind of bitter about their work.
Yeah.
And
I try not to go into that direction.
Yeah, I think that staying focused on the process of and the pleasure. I mean, writing is also really hard and to do. And there's something that's been really sustaining about having someone else. I've never been married to anyone else, and so I don't know. But I think that there is something sustaining about knowing that there is another person nearby who is writing.
But you know, you get sick of literature and the whole literary world and the whole literary community sometimes, and just kind of, you know, and you just sometimes, unless I do sometimes, especially mm-hmm. lately, I've been like just not wanting to think about it as much. So it's a literary world that's been so turned upside down by the way publishing works and social media, and I'm not a social media person. Mm-hmm. I just try to not think about it much. And I do a lot of, I'm not teaching now anymore, so I do just do a lot of other things too to keep my brain sort of in a healthy place.
Yeah. I think another thing that Dominic and I have in common is a love of film.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so we, yeah.
Film, television.
I might love it more than you do.
But... Well, we watch a lot of the same stuff. And we watch a lot of Antonioni lately. And yeah, it's pretty fun. Gillian comes up with a lot of...
Have you made any time to see the Barbenheimer?
Yeah.
Yeah, have you?
We've seen them both. Yeah.
You mean the two movies that everybody's talking about right now?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
We saw Oppenheimer first.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. We went to
Barbie. Did you see Barbie? Have you seen Barbie?
I was the only one. I was the only guy alone. There were like 200 girls with
no, I didn't want to be
that. What did you think? What did you think?
I loved it.
I was, right?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
I was surprised.
Yeah, me too.
It was like a big piece of candy, you know? It was just wonderful.
It was great. How about Oppenheimer?
I like that too. My dad was in, I recognize the sort of Hollywood parts of it, you know, but my dad was in that world. My dad was worked in nuclear weapons development, more as a communication engineer, but he was down there in that triangle where he was a little younger than Oppenheimer. My dad only passed recently. And my uncle was there too during World War II when those things were tested. Not during that stuff at Trinity. And my uncle died as a result of the radiation cancer. My father was there, didn't go there. He went there later because he's younger and was doing missile communication stuff and was out to Trinity and in the triangle all the time. Never talked about it much. He actually was kind of in his own way, an anarchist. He didn't like the military that much, though he was closely associated with it. It was interesting to see him at a certain point having that same kind of. He had a breakdown when he was in his, and like about 1968 or so, when he was after coming home from working in those places, and had a hard time with it. But he was also very patriotic in another kind of way, because we would go to the baseball games and he would put his hand right over his heart, and so it was interesting, you know. And so I liked seeing that world get developed. And to see it. And some of my own writing lately has been dealing, even though, you know, I'm a crime novelist, has been dealing with that time period in retrospection, in retrospect, because of my dad's time there. And since he passed recently, it's been very fascinating to me to think about him down there and what I don't know about him and what he never spoke about.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting what you said, Joaquin, about, you know, it's impossible for Americans to put a president in jail, you know, in prison. And whereas in other countries, it happens all the time. And that's the power of that is so frightening. You know, that just that alone is like really frightening that we wouldn't do that. And it'll be interesting to see if we do it, if we can.
Well, I can understand why you don't want to start putting presidents in jail,
but
though.
Why not? If they're criminals.
Well, if they're criminals, yeah, but you know, but then each party's going to start, they all do criminal stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're going to put Biden's son, Biden, in jail too for whatever is. It gets so easy to put them all in jail that you have everybody doing political, whatever you call it, political action against the other party all the time. Yeah. So I can see why that's a road you prefer not to go down. But Trump's not going to be like Nixon. I think somebody said this on television. Mm-hmm. Nixon, you know, cooperated when they impeached him and waved goodbye from the helicopter. Trump, you know, who seems like very gracious in retrospect now.
Yeah.
At that time, Nixon seemed like so horrifying. But now he seems like, you know, he was a gracious sociopath. Trump's like, he's not going to go gently into the good night.
No.
He doesn't have any sense of dignity in the way that those older crooks did.
I just think there hasn't been in many decades, and now what you were talking about your uncle's crisis for his participation in all of these events back in, you know, during the war, the test for what we might call the American character that's coming up throughout this process. I find that process incredibly interesting. That the response that, you know, the Americans as an entity, people, government, politicians, etc., writers, how are we going to deal with this? Because this is a very crucial moment, I think, for everyone.
But I think there's one danger right now, and I think it comes through the whole Hunter Biden angle, because I think what, and this is not just my thought, I mean, while I'm relatively well-informed in politics, I'm not a politician or I don't think like that, but I think the danger is that the Republicans will try to say, oh, yeah, what Trump was doing might not be totally kosher, but look at Hunter Biden and try to equate these things. But whatever Hunter Biden did, like however he enriched himself because he was the vice president's son or so, That has nothing to do with trying to overturn an election and incite violence. And to and they are going to try to equate that and say, oh, everybody's corrupt, so you can still vote for us. But to really point out that, no, this is an entirely different thing. This is, mm-hmm. as you said, Dominic, way worse than what Nixon even ever did. Mm-hmm.
And no, Nixon just did a mild break-in compared to that. And it was a clumsy affair anyway, the Watergate break-in. Yeah. And it's nothing compared to the amount of what's going on these days.
No. Yeah. Nixon is just a, you know, paranoid narcissist. And Hunter Biden's just a you know, petty crook that had a crack problem.
Well, he's not a petty crook. He got some good money.
Well, but okay. But I mean, I just don't see how on earth you could.
None of us would get away with any of this. Really? None of us would get away with this. We'd be down under.
I have a question for you, Gillian. I understand how a novelist might deal with historical events in fiction, but how does a poet deal with historical events of this kind?
Oh, a lot of poetry is extremely political, especially right now. And when I was younger, like I remember when I first started writing, I was really, really young, and it was the 70s, and there was an attitude of not having politics in American poetry. You know, I don't know. I never really understood why that was or where it came from. And when you would read poetry in which, you know, this is like right after the Vietnam War, and it would be, you know, poetry by, say, like W.S. Merwin or Mark Strand, or, you know, that whole group of, they were all white male poets. And they would, or James Wright, they would all, there was some very fuzzy, distant metaphor of like a stone or a rock or, you know, darkness. I mean, I think Mark Strand has a whole book called Darkness or Dark, you know, something like that. And it was very, it was not direct in the least. But what they were ultimately writing about was this kind of, you know, grief and sadness over Vietnam, with the exception of W.S. Merwin's book, The Lice, which is an incredible book and holds up to this day, of being, you know, just like, you know, lice are like parasites. And it's just it's a wonderful book. And it is about Vietnam without ever mentioning the word Vietnam. And then, you know, there are people that say that Beckett is really writing about Ireland without ever mentioning the word, you know, the country Ireland. So, you know, there's a huge precedence for all of this. But now there's just a real, you know, very out front, forward political work in poetry going on. From LGBTQ writers, BIPOC, everyone, you know, there still is a eco-poetics movement going on. But at this point, I mean, you know, the earth is dying, and poetry, everyone is writing about the climate. And so anyway, all of that has radically, radically, radically changed. And it's, I think it's a really great thing to see that. It's just in my own lifetime. I really have been overjoyed to see that happen.
Have you personally written political poetry?
Yeah. I think that my work has become much more political in the last 3 or 4 books for sure. And my new book is located in a post apocalyptic catastrophic world. And it there are poems in it that where white privilege is, you know, is present. there's a, so yes. And I did a selected poems, and which a couple of years ago, and I was kind of petrified to do it because you have to go and look at your really early work. And, you know, my first two books were really autobiographical, and they were different from my other books, and I was dreading doing it. But then I was actually happy to see that all along I had been writing about things like race and gender. And so that I didn't have anything. I do feel a lot of shame and guilt. And I've looked at, magazines, for example, that I used to publish in when I was younger. And you look at the roster of the names of people on the, and it's like, you know, maybe there's one person of color, maybe there's someone who's LGBTQ, you know, but it's totally tokenism. And you go, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, that's, and at the time, you're, you know, stupid enough to think that that was somehow okay, or you didn't notice, or so for that there to be a comeuppance and hey, you know, look at what's been going on for so long, and now it's not going on anymore, is a very beautiful thing.
I think Gillian and I may differ a little bit here on this, but I don't find Gillian's work to be, I think I would say that sure there's politics in the work, but it's more, I tend to not like work that tells me what to think about a political issue.
Yeah.
That tells me this is that. I like stuff that's a little more complicated and it works in a metaphoric way. And I don't find Gillian's stuff to be taking a party line on anything like that. Sure, there's stuff in there about apocalypse, and there's stuff in there about all the things that we all are experiencing and concerns. And there's plenty of irony in there. And so, and it's like and so my own, if work is trying to tell me what to think about Trump, or even if I happen to agree with it, and all of a sudden it comes into a work of fiction or into a poem, I'm like, you know, hey, save that for someplace else. You know, I don't really want to know your politics because it's interfering with the work. It's interfering with the aesthetics of the work, and it's interfering with the inner world. And if you're trying to write about, you know, fascism or creeping this or creeping that, then maybe if you're going to write about Trump, you do that in another place. I'm not saying that can't work in fiction or it can't work in poetry, because certainly it can. But for the most part, you know, people wearing their politics on their sleeves, and I, even if it's politics that I agree with, I pretty much, it shuts me down. Yeah. Maybe it's a defensive mechanism or something. Maybe I'm wrong. But, and also, you know, I think there's a creeping fascism inside the left-wing gender identity politics also too. Mm-hmm. And we've all seen it at the universities and other places. We aren't allowed to really speak or say anything, even in passing, that's might be construed as this or that, or that you're not of the same opinion of whatever happens to be dominant. And so, you know, I agree with things that come out of the far right. I don't necessarily agree with their conclusions, but I agree. I understand I empathize or understand, or can at least see why it is that people feel that they have been alienated and pushed out and nobody's been paying attention to it. Now, why attach to Trump? Why attach to Mussolini? Why attach to Hitler? Because of whatever people do. I'm not saying I put Trump in that same category or not, but why people go that way, I don't necessarily think that's good. But I try the best I can to be empathetic with people of very different political views than my own happen to be. So I'm not entirely convinced of my own politics, because I know how transitory those things are. And because in Europe, and you guys maybe know a little bit more about this than I do, but in Europe, during the World War II, I like Céline as a writer. I don't know if you know who's, you know, Céline, the French writer, who's kind of, you know, his own personal politics were somewhat disgusting, right? But on the ground in Europe, in France, for some people like him, like Newt Hampson and other writers, the choice was not between the Americans and some idea of democracy. It was between Stalin and Hitler. So if you're on the ground in Europe in 1938, who do you take sides with? Mm-hmm. You know, who is your person? Is it Hitler who had a working class feel, or is it Stalin and the so-called Jewish conspiracy, right? Because so I think you have to think about that, because, you know, I mean, I don't want to go on for too long.
Yeah. But, I think you're talking about two things. At the when you first started talking, you're talking about didacticism, you know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, didactic politics.
Which you don't want in your work, and then but also a recognition of how complicated history is, and to know that history and the choices that people had to make.
Yeah.
To stay alive, and often, you know, they would make, I don't know, I mean, what you know, look at Gertrude Stein, and she was completely protected in France, and apparently watched the Nazis take these little girls that were Jewish out of school and, you know, put them in a truck, and off they went the whole time while she was being protected. And now she's this great modernist poet, and people don't take her to task that much about that.
But, I didn't know that. That's true.
Yeah, she was protected. She and Alice B. Toklas were protected by
The Germans.
You know, right before we started recording, Tim Trash and I were, I was telling Tim that I felt that as I age, I was becoming more conservative, or I would be perceived as more conservative. And I think that just to the point that Dominic was making, that reality is very complex. And we came to a point where we don't want to acknowledge the complexity of reality. And we feel very comfortable in isolated camps, where, you know, everything is black and everything is white, and we cannot find a middle ground, a point of compromise or negotiation to acknowledge that the other in front of us might also be a human, might also be experiencing pain, suffering, you know, that complexity that makes us what we are. Mm-hmm. And I feel very uncomfortable in this position, where some of the things that I might think I cannot say, because I will be immediately censored and marginalized, especially in academia where I teach. Mm-hmm. So I know that I cannot speak at ease and openly about many of the things that I really think, you know, and I'm convinced of, because they will be misinterpreted and taken in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying, well, I'm a Nazi, you know, I'm like this.
Oh, no, yeah. I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah.
But just very simple things like acknowledging the complexity of things, the paradox of reality, cannot be discussed openly these days.
No, I think that's largely true, that any of the sort of big topics that we're facing right now, there's no space where they can be discussed without the politics, without the shouting down, where you can actually have a conversation that is as complex as the issue is. Because if people don't see that you're for this or against that or whatever, I think there's little patience with the complexity. It has to be married to a political stance, and that makes it often, I think, very, very hard to start even the conversation, because, you know, people will try to push you into certain cubbyholes and say, oh, that's you, and you do this. But I, while I'm aware of that and very uncomfortable with that at times, what makes me really, really feel unmoored and angry and frustrated is that I think we're at a point where we're entering the stage of an alternate reality entirely. I mean, partly it was always there. Conspiracy theories were always present in any society. But now they're, of course, disseminated in much wider circles. But we're now at a point where people cannot even agree on the basic on a basic notion of reality. And there it gets really, really, really weird. And just one little instance, I was one teaching a class at the end of 2012, and Obama had been reelected, and students thought that he had not won the popular vote in that class. And I was like, whoa, let's stop a moment. Let's check our iPhones. And so we got to that, but all these little alternate reality scenarios that are now rampant, where Democrats have black masses and fornicate with underage kids and all that. I mean, it's getting so bizarre where you can't even breach a topic anymore, where you can't talk about anything anymore. And so it's getting harder to even have any kind of discussion. And that's a very frightful state where you can't agree on what's real and what's not anymore.
It's very dangerous because there's so many different versions of reality being put in front of us. And, you know, with AI coming in, that's really going to knock everything, or is knocking everything askew. So, you know, what is truth and what is impossible?
Yeah, I'm just waiting for Trump to say his call to Georgia to Greg Raffensperger was AI, and that wasn't really his voice in there. I'm just waiting for that.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And then there's so many kind of catchphrases, or, you know, there's so many gestures that can be made where people think that if I do a land acknowledgement, for example, that pretty much takes care of everything that happened to Native Americans in the United States. You know, we've dealt with that. And, you know, if we do this, then we've dealt with slavery. Or if we do, and they, it's not to say they're not completely empty gestures, but in some ways, some gestures can have the effect of a kind of escapism, almost, of not really dealing with the seriousness and the complexity of the history of the country.
There's an interesting article in Harper's about that kind of gesturing, and it looks like it's going to be an attack on woke politics. And in some ways it is, but it's really not. It's actually further to the left than that. But it says it's talking about, it's about Protestantism and the impulse to apologize in public for something as part of a Protestant evangelical thing that goes back to Puritanism. And it really, it's a surface apology, and it's kind of like not really all, it's more revealing about the culture than it is about and how it deals with its own inadequacies rather than about the situation.
That we would pay reparations or apologize just to feel better about ourselves afterwards, and basically say, now we're done with that.
It's actually the article was more just seeing that as a very kind of similar to the kind of sewing on of a scarlet letter, and isolating guilt by pointing, isolating possibility by pointing at it, and the necessity to get up and testify and say the appropriate thing. And if you get up and say the appropriate thing, like all the corporations are doing that same thing with their little woke statements ahead of their TV commercials, and that is just completely pretty much where the ultimate point of this article is to say, yeah, we have all kinds of problems with race and whatever, but it's hiding this infatuation with race and gender and identity is really ignoring, to everybody's convenience, the elephant in the room, which is economic, which is the split between the wealthy and the poor in this country, and how that has just gotten incredibly worse. And that's where all the anxiety is coming out of the white working class, because they feel like they've been fucked, and they have. Mm-hmm. And so have the people of color. And so that's a real problem. That's a big elephant in the room is the money, is the class, is the class differences. And that's an old Marxist argument that he says maybe people should be paying more attention to Marx. I was surprised at this, because this looked like you were going to get a Republican attack on wokeism. The left concluded should be paying more attention to Marx than they are to Calvin and Luther.
Yeah.
And stop it with the big long finger on the and on the social media, and you're guilty of this, you're guilty of that, mm-hmm. or at least think about it a little bit more, and think about the underlying problem there. Which is the lack of equity.
Yeah.
How do you do that without being called a socialist? That's why it's much easier for the people to have a committee on UFOs right now than it is to talk about anything that's of substance. The Democrats aren't going to criticize that, because they don't want to be considered QAnon people. So they'll go along with a UFO investigation, but they're not going to talk about how to give everybody a deal with real money issues and the rent problems. Our daughter, you know, who's from a relatively, you know, well-off background, and her boyfriend, they you know what the rents are in Santa Rosa. She can't afford it. They want to move in together. They can't afford it. No. And she has a full-time job working at Woodlands making $20 an hour. I don't want to get into this too much. And then he works. He's making two really good working class wages. Cannot go together to buy a rent. They can't. Mm-hmm. So how if they can't do it, how can anybody, and they're from people, they have parents who live in Marin County, how can anybody do it? You know, that's a big problem. I know a lot of people whose daughters and whatever, this younger generation, just unless they're, you know, young nuclear scientists, computer engineers, whatever, you know, or they're entrepreneurs, if they're just regular people who go to get their liberal arts degree or flunk out of the junior college, whatever, they're not going to be able to do it. It's just tough.
There was something about how Zuckerberg had made some kind of gesture on Facebook that was an anti-racist gesture. I forget what it was that he did, but at the same time, he was investing in and giving money to facial recognition.
That's the Amazon guy.
That's the Amazon guy.
I'm talking about Bezos. They make the gesture over here, and then they do something else over there. And so, you know, that's Bezos.
So anyway.
Doing a George Floyd thing, anti-George Floyd, anti-whatever. And at the same time, that maybe was a different guy too, but at the same time, giving money to the police departments for facial identification software. So they play it both ways. This is big corporations, and we expect them to do that. But
it's just an example of the hypocrisy.
Right.
That we're probably all guilty of at some level.
Yeah. But the silencing is scary, and I don't know. It's very interesting to talk about this with both of y'all, because you're born in other countries, and yet here you are stuck in the United States.
Well. By choice.
I never thought really that kind of thing, that kind of radicalization could happen in the United States. That all kinds of horrible things happen in the United States. Okay, that's common knowledge. But this radicalization is something that, the way I grew up with just television, radio, and a landline phone, that I thought was, in a country of this size, just not feasible. And that was what American history was, that, yeah, things erupted in certain points and you had movements, but on the whole, they never had the chance to overrun the country. But now we're living in a world where actually something like that can overrun a country. And we saw that with January 6th, that people are being mobilized, not just in a very small area, but online across the whole nation. And they can come from everywhere to descend on Washington and cause mayhem there. And that's a scary part. I always thought of America as just too disparate, too large, too cumbersome in its politics to get behind a strong man. That wouldn't work. But now it does work. And that kind of new reality has me very scared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in a country like Germany, like Hitler made sense. Mussolini made sense. Those were small countries. Mm-hmm. But Hitler in America never made really sense, you know. But now we're closer to that scenario. And it's uncomfortable.
Do you think it's like it's capital? It's like capitalism. Is that? I mean, because like Elon Musk, for example, he's shooting off these rockets, you know,
satellites.
And this was a big article in the New York Times, I think last Sunday, and he's doing more and more of them. And if he decides to do that in Ukraine, for example, he could, you know,
yeah,
just do a lot. And who, you know.
Right now he's letting the Ukrainians use his satellite network for communication.
Yeah, but he might get tired of them.
Well, he suggested that he might.
But the U.S. is buying, the government is buying a lot of satellites so they can take a little bit of control out of his hands. And that's
now they are buying his satellites so that Ukraine can use them, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful, and I have to be because I also have a child, and I think that will somehow make it to this really dark time in the US. I really hope so. It's not a terrible place. I mean, you just pointed out that, you know, you're speaking with right now to two immigrants who have done well, reasonably well as immigrants. And many, many of my friends who are immigrants from Mexico, from Argentina, from Eastern Europe have done very well in the U.S. And what's also a sad reality is that we had opportunities that many American-born folks never had. And that speaks to a system that is not fair, but also speaks, I think, to individual effort and you know, some kind of willingness to do what it takes to get the job done. And I think immigrants do that. I mean, everyone who is right, most of the people who are now Americans had an immigrant in their families, except for
mm-hmm. well, sure.
or Black Americans who were enslaved. Mm-hmm. But I think that the project, the American project, is not dead. I'm hopeful.
Go ahead.
on that somewhat hopeful note. We have to come to our recommendations, the FDF list, try at your own risk. Gillian and Dominic, what do you have for us? Who wants to go first?
Do you want to go?
I would recommend a song by George Gershwin called Summertime. The reason I would recommend it because it's been recorded many, many times. It has and just like getting into any one, it's an example of like taking one piece of anything and getting into the history of it. I've listened to like about 20, I'm trying to learn how to play it on a piano, but it's also 25, almost like 20,000 versions of it. And there's so many different things, and there's a controversy around the song because of the time when it was written for an opera, that black opera that Gershwin had written for an all African American cast. But it's also been widely performed by African American performers with a lot of affection and are still performing, and to some controversy also. So it's and it's a beautiful song, and you know, I can't do it justice trying to sing it, but it's like, you know, it's just getting into something in that depth, and you listen to it from many different ways.
My recommendation is a band called Wet Leg that I believe they're fabulous. I think they're from the UK, and it's an all-female band. And my favorite song is a song called Chaise Lounge.
Chaise Lounge. But no, she's pronouncing it right.
The singer pronounces it correctly.
It's a UK pronunciation.
It's a UK and French. Anyway, they're great. Wet Leg.
Little kind of a punk, whatever.
Fried Chicken, I recommend. and cucumbers, not necessarily
in summertime
order. And summertime, I've been to summertime. The zombies version of summertime is really good.
Oh wow! Well, got to check them out. Awesome, very cool.
I love those recommendations. I'll check out Wet Leg, and I love summertime. I'm going to recommend Barbie. I know that a lot of people already watch Barbie, but I know that maybe
on the Wet Leg thing.
Many people are not watching Barbie because they think it's the opposite of what it is, and they're in for a surprise. I know the work of this director, and I've seen two of her films before, so I knew I wasn't going to be disappointed, and I wasn't. I really, really like Barbie.
Wow, cool. So I will turn totally prosaic here. So I have really bad allergies every summer, but this summer especially. So I always wake up with a dry mouth in the morning, and like a really, really dry mouth. And I went online and looked for home remedies, and people suggested buying a humidifier. And so I went online and I bought a humidifier, a very cheap one, $20 on the Amazon. And it does not help for the dry mouth, but it's really, really good to keep my head clear, because usually in the mornings I wake up and I have, like, I feel completely stuffed up. I sit there for half an hour blowing my nose. It's almost painful. And I wake now up after using the humidifier, and I have a clear head. And so it's really awesome. It's super quiet. You can't really hear it at night. And it's the Raydrop ultrasonic humidifier. As I said, you can buy it on Amazon for $20. It's really cheap. It holds 1.7 liters. So it lasts a whole night. It has an automatic shutoff, so it's really easy to use. And yeah, it's beautiful. If I had known about that, I would have done that much earlier, but it's great. It's fantastic. So that's my very prosaic recommendation. Gillian and Dominic, thank you so, so, so much for coming on the show.
It was fun to talk to you. It was really fun.
That was good.
We will
to talk to you.
We'll continue.
Yes, absolutely.
Other spaces, other rooms, other voices, other rooms.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I haven't had a chance to
No, it would be fun.
Joaquin or Tim. Well, Tim, I know. Joaquin, I know too now.
Yes.
Tim, Joaquin.
I love these alter egos. I'm not really Gillian, and he's not really Dominic either. No, don't tell you.
It actually don't exist.
Later. No, this is all AI. We've shown up in
totally. We never existed in the first place. Our music is by Springtide. It's their Coney Island Train Blues, and it comes to us via the Free Music Archive. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you catch us again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Adios.